Professor for British Brain here. What I'm going to talk about today, besides what you can read from the title, is Offenheim Lagrangian proof of a set of three-level QCD recursion relations, which were discovered by Federica Chatzo and his friends, Britta and Frank, and later on proved by the same group of people in collaboration with Ed Witten. And I'll show how the approach which I'm going to provide for you can be very easily extended, not to just address three-level gluon recurrence relations, but to include massive or master scalars and even fermions. So here is an outline of my talk, the usual introduction. Then I'm going to present for you a perhaps lesser-known gauge choice for Super-Young-Neutrinos theory, which goes by the name of space phone gauge. It has been, well, it was invented by Warren Ziegler and Gordon Chalmers. Then I'll show how this turns to be the right language to prove the QCD recurrence relation at the level of Feynman diagram, and I'll give a few examples. Then I'll give a proof on the three-level recurrence relation based on the logic Feynman equation. I'll sketch how this is done in a very concrete example. And I'll sketch how a general proof should go. And then if time allows, I'll discuss how to include fermions in these three-level recurrence relations. And I'll end with conclusions and future directions. So the introduction, as almost everybody knows by now, over the last couple of years, great progress has been made in providing alternative approaches to perturbative QCD calculations. And all these new developments have been spurred by Witten's seminal paper, in which he reformulated perturbative n equal 4 Super-Young-Neels as a string theory on crystal space. Afterwards, Witten, in collaboration with Cacciazzo and Svircher, provided an alternative to the usual Feynman diagrammatics to computing three-level gluon amplitudes, QCD amplitudes, based on what is now called MHV rules. MHV is an acronym which stands for maximally helicity violating vertices. These arise as an offshore continuation of the simplest non-vanishing three-level gluon amplitudes, which are maximally helicity violating. These amplitudes require that two, all gluons by two to have the same helicity. And based on these MHV rules, Brito, Cacciazzo, and Fenn discovered a set of on-shell recurrence relations. And in collaboration with Witten, they provided a proof of those on-shell recurrence relations, three-level recurrence relations, I should stress, based on the analytic properties of the three-level gluon amplitudes. When I started to think about this subject together with Ed Yao, it became sort of obvious to us that these three-level recurrence relations, by the virtue of being on-shell, they bear on the cutting rules in the field theory. In fact, this idea of using cutting rules is not new, and it has been used with a great success over the last decade by Zvi Ban, Lance Dixon, and David Posover, most notably. And it is another information that adds to clarify this puzzle, which follows from the fact that the unitarity of the S matrix and the existence of an ordering among the sequence of space-time points, which goes by the name of the largest time equation, are intimately related. So this is how we ended up bringing the largest time equation into the recipe of proving the three-level on-shell recurrence relation from a Lagrangian standpoint. But before you even begin, it's best to think a little bit which particular formulation of QCD, and by this I mean which gauge choice and which particular ordering among the sequence of space-time points is the most suited for a field theoretical derivation of the Ohmschild recurrence equation. And the answer that we provided is that space-time gauge QCB and a light-like ordering are best suited to approach this problem. And here is the summary, just in case I might find myself pressed by time towards the end of my talk and I'll rush to the conclusion. And second reason to present the summary right now is that I hope it's going to allow me to give a more pedagogical presentation if I tell you right from the beginning what you expect to hear from me over the last 50 minutes, over the next 50 minutes or so. So the idea is that we want to give a purely quantum field theoretical derivation of these Ohmschild recurrence relations, also known as BCFW, at the level of the Feynman diagrams. As I already mentioned, a key ingredient is the use of the space-time gauge. You'll see how this already simplifies the Ohmschild recurrence relation to the point that you're just facing a trivial algebraic identity. If you ask the question, what is behind that trivial algebraic identity, which is trivially satisfied, the answer that comes is that the three-level recurrence relation emerges at the more fundamental level from the largest time equation. And I'll describe this for you. And I already mentioned that our results lend themselves to natural generalization to include massive scalars and fermions. So for the few people in the audience who are not familiar with the spinor-helicity formalism, here is one introductory slide, hopefully with the right amount of information. Let me begin by reminding you that if you complexify the Lorentz group, then a four-component Lorentz vector can be written as a bispinor. This is a bispinor via this definition. So you can write the mu with sigma mu a dot. These are four matrices, which are two by two matrices. Four. It's a set of four matrices, each of them being the two by two matrix. Sigma zero is just the identity. Sigma one, two, three are the Pauli matrices. So this vector now is a bispinor, is a two by two matrix. And the entries on the diagonal, you have the light-home component. And on the off-diagonal, you have the space-home component. And I'm going to use, in what follows, capital letters to denote the four-component vectors and lowercase letters to denote their components. The inner product of two vectors then can be written as a product of these bispinors. You take the product of the matrices, you take the trace. These indices are raised and lowered with the anti-symmetric two-component tensor, epsilon AB, epsilon A dot B dot. The norm of a vector is given by the determinant of that matrix. And the basic principle behind twisters is that if you have a null vector, that is, if this matrix has rank zero, has determinant zero, then a null vector can be written as the product of two spinors, commuting spinors, a positive helicity spinor and a negative helicity spinor. And now we can define angular products and square products, which are given by these expressions, and remembering that these indices are raised and lowered with the epsilon tensor. That means that these products are skew symmetric. And now I come to the point where I introduce the space-time gauge. We've already saw how a four-component vector can be decomposed into light-like components and space-home components. Here the space-home and the light-home components. Now, it's very clear to see, that the same components arise as the components of a vector which is decomposed into this spinor helicity basis, right? Next, one goes to the Young-Lewis theory Lagrangian. I don't need to explain anything about this line. Chalmers and Ziegel in 1998 observed that the Feynman diagrams most optimized if instead of fixing the usual axial gauges, A1, A2, A3 equal 0, or the Lightman gauge, A plus equal 0, the Feynman diagrams are optimized in this unorthodox gauge, which they call spaceform gauge. So what you're doing is you're setting to 0 by using the gauge invariants. You're setting to 0 the component of A along a vector, which is null. It is null because clearly it can be written as the product of two spinors. But you see you're not setting to 0 the component A plus. So this would be light-like, light-form gauge. You're setting to 0 one of these space-form components, complex components, A. And that's all very straight. If then you go ahead and...
Excuse me, sorry. So you're already complexifying everything, the momenta, the momenta complex.
Yes.
Otherwise, A
absolutely,
bar is
zero. Absolutely.
So A bar is not the complex conjugate of A.
That's right. And however, you can eliminate A bar from its equation of motion. It's an auxiliary field, so you can eliminate it, and you can go and write down this Lagrangian, which is the Lagrangian of essentially of a complex Taylor field. So this field A plus corresponds to a positive Helsky gluon, A minus corresponds to a negative Helsky gluon.
But at the level of the Lagrangian, it's a little bit strange to complexify everything. How do you define the integrations at the level of an action?
Let me then go back one step and see. So what I'm doing is to set to 0 one of these four components, which I'm entitled to.
Yes, but if A is a real vector in Minkowski space, A bar is a complex conjugate of
A. A is not real. A is equal to A1 minus I2.
Yes, but B1 and B2 or A1 and A2 are real vectors, capital A.
These ones are real vectors, yes.
Right.
So A is complex.
So if you said B2 to be 0, that would imply that the other one is also 0.
Right, so in some sense, yes, you have to complexify these guys. Right,
right.
That's absolutely correct.
Which
yes.
is a funny thing to do at the level of the Lagrangian.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have any comments about that.
But
in some sense, it is fairly standard to do such a thing, and some of these calculations that have been done in CRISPR space, particularly when you localize gluons on pairs of, let's say, the highest degree, and what you're doing, you're integrating over the moduli space, over things that you treat them as if they're real, but somehow you have to sum over all solutions to those moduli, which are complex. So it's on that same footing.
But the recognition diagnosis doesn't depend on A bar.
No, because I've already eliminated it. It's an auxiliary field which you can eliminate via its equations of motion. That's why you see all these 1 over the...
Yeah,
no,
it's
not
a
equation.
No, because it's different. The two operations are not giving the same answer.
The other thing that I can say is that if you start with Lagrangian, it doesn't look that different from the Lightform gauge with Lagrangian.
They look a bit similar.
Absolutely. It's sometimes instead of having the 1 over b,
yes.
which brings down. So if you have a 1 over b operator, the meaning of this thing is that you act on e to the I t x. So it's going to bring down the 1 over the lowercase component of b. So p as a 4-component vector has p bar p plus. Minus components is 1 over d brings 1 over d plus the bound. So that's the meaning of it. The same as in the Lightman gauge, you have 1 over d plus in the Lagrangian, which translates 1 over d plus factors in the Feynman diagram. So I don't have any reason to offer you as to why I should trust this, but it seems to work, and it's not the first time we saw examples in which complexifying things is actually the right thing to do.
Lagrangian is complex.
This Lagrangian?
Yeah.
When you have this 1 over d downstairs, so it appears as if it is complex, but in fact it's not. It gives the right Feynman diagrams and the right, I should say, the right amplitudes. And if you allow me, I'll clearly demonstrate that for you.
So maybe there should be a justification for that. Like if you complexify a bar, you should also complexify in this case. You know, the gauge transformation, and then maybe the quotient of the
two or
give the same space.
Plus, you know, if you vic rotate and if you work with, let's say, SO2, 2, maybe things would make better sense. Right? Because in that case, you wouldn't have this problem that you just have right now. So a simple vic rotation would perhaps take care of it. So now let me introduce this twister basis. The simplest way, as I said, the way to generate the simplest Feynman diagrams is to identify the elements of this twister basis, of generalistic basis, in terms of two external gluons, which will have momenta denoted here by T and T. And again, the recipe for generating the simplest Feynman rules is that for an external gluon with positive helicity, you define the elements of the twister basis is lambda A and lambda A dot, negative elements of this basis from T, which has positive helicity, and from a negative helicity external gluon, you define the remaining two components of the spinner helicity basis, the plus ones. And I was asking myself, is this the only way to go? The answer to it is that it is the only way to go if you want to generate simple Feynman rules. But it's by no means necessary. For instance, you could play the same game that I'm going to describe afterwards. If you just select two gluons with the same helicity, and again, you find these negative and positive components of the spinner helicity phase. Now, since the Lagrangian, which I just described for you, is essentially a complex scalar, the Lagrangian of a complex scalar field, which nonetheless we intend to use to compute gluon amplitudes. That means that externalized factors have to be supplied by hand. So first we define polarization vectors, which are subject to this constraint. These are simply normalization factors, and for every positive helicity gluon, you have to supply this externalized factor. For every negative helicity gluon, you have to supply this length factor. It is obvious, I hope, that for the gluons which you use to define the space bound gauge vector, n is plus minus. So remember, we selected two external helicity gluons to define the plus and the minus elements of the twister basis, which means that we use two external helicity gluons to define the space gauge vector. So now, for those vectors, for P and Q, if you now look at the composition of this twister basis, you'll see that the only non-partition components, because this is P and this is Q, the only non-partition components are going to be P minus, which is 1, and P plus, which is 1. So that means that P and Q, lowercase P and lowercase Q, vanish, which is perhaps dangerous, but not entirely, since the externalized factors vanish at the exact same time. So we have P vanishing, but these externalized factors for the positive helicity gluon and the negative helicity gluon vanish too. So it's a business of 0/0, which at the end of the day means that the reference gluons which have a positive helicity participate only in plus plus minus vertices, and negative helicity gluons participate, reference gluons participate only in minus minus plus vertices. and this was just all the view material. Here is how you compute three-point functions, plus, plus, minus. This is the only one which is a little bit different because you have to select, you have to supply another arbitrary null vector to define the plus elements of the crystal basis. But then everything is very simple. Let's say you use P1, which is a plus helicity gluon to define the negative elements of the crystal basis. So P1 is going to be minus, minus. And then you can compute plus, plus, minus straightforwardly. And this is the usual holomorphic or anti-holomorphic because my convention's expression for a maximal helicity violating the gluon amplitude. And for a four-point function, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4 are my gluons, with plus, minus, 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 plus, minus, minus, plus helicities. We need two opposite helicity gluons to define the reference vector. One is a positive helicity gluon, so it's going to define the minus element of the crystal basis. Two is a negative helicity gluon, it's going to define the plus element of the crystal basis. And because this is the diagram that we're computing. This is a reference gluon, this is the other reference gluon. They can participate only in plus, plus, minus, 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 plus vertices. This is the only diagram that you have to compute. Supply the line factors for gluon number 3 and gluon number 4. Remember, the line factors of gluon number 1 and gluon number 2, which were referenced, have been already accounted for. And again, straightforwardly, the usual maximal helicity violating amplitude result. So that was space blockage. Now, what are you going to use it for? We're interested in offering a proof for these three-level gluon onshore recurrence relations, which state that an endpoint function can be written as products of lower endpoint functions. So these are onshore amplitude multiplied by the propagator of the total momentum that flows to the left part of this diagram, or by momentum conservation by the right part of this diagram, such that upon selecting two gluons as reference, you factorize this amplitude while preserving the cyclicity of your gluon phase, and you write all possible terms such that these reference gluons P and Q belong to different onshore amplitudes. And since momentum conservation law can be preserved only if you shift these two reference gluons by the same opposite, but of same in magnitude but opposite amount, then what it means that these hybrid gluons are defined to be the momentum of these, well, these are gluon moment of the reference gluons, and the hybrid components are equal to the momentum of the reference gluons minus the eta, plus the eta, eta is null. And the condition that after the shift, P hat and Q hat are still on shell means that eta is transverse to both P and Q. I hope this is clear. So I have a lower endpoint function. It's an amplitude, it's not a Feynman diagram, which is written as products of lower endpoint functions. So by this is the essence of having an onshore recurrence relation. And the thing that you have to remember, it's already obvious if you think about it, is that you have to shift certain momenta in order to preserve the momentum conservation. And if you stare at this equation, which tells you that you have a null vector, which is transverse to the momenta of both reference gluons, you realize that this eta is nothing else but the space cone gauge vector, which was transverse by definition. of external momenta used to define it. So what I'm going to do next is to use the cutting rules which follow from the largest time equation and use the space Phong gauge QCD Lagrangian to provide a direct proof of the speed of actions of Phong with an onshore recurrence relations. So this I've already explained. And here is a very important point at the derivation. And it's sort of really the crux of the problem. You see, once you decide that you have external momenta, which you, is there any razor around? Which you're going to shift. So what we're doing is to send P into P hat, which is equal to P plus zeta. And we have a QCD Lagrangian with derivative couplings. So what it means that every single shift that you make has the potential to propagate to every single vertex. And proving these onshore recurrence relations at the level of Feynman diagrams is quite problematic if you have to account for how these vertices are affected by the shift. However, the magic of the space Phong gauge is that if you compute p hat on components, it has the exact same components as p. Obviously, it cannot be equal to p, but the only shift, the only noticeable effect of the shift is in a component, which is p bar. So with this definition for eta, this p and this q, then p hat in components, the only non-branching components are p minus hat, which is 1. Obviously, I haven't changed my crystal phase. And p hat bar. All the others are vanishing. P hat bar turns out to be equal to minus z, q hat bar is equal to z. Do these shifts change the vertices? And if you remember again the Lagrangian which I wrote before, you see all the derivatives. All the derivative dependence comes with b minus, b plus, and b. No d bar inside because we've eliminated a bar by its equation of motion. So what this means is that we have good news that the space Phong gauge vertices are insensitive to the shift. And you only have to account for the effects of the shift in the parameters. And if you realize this, you're already home free. Here is an example, which is a trivial one. A four-point function. So we're going to look at the same four-point function that I described here before. And let's see what the BCFW recurrence relation instructs us to do. Split this four-point function into lower endpoint functions. Well, these are going to be three-point functions. Isolating on the two sides the reference bonds, which are denoted by these blue lines for you to be able to distinguish them. So here are the amplitudes. The lower endpoint function. And so decompose this into products of lower endpoint function and multiply them by the inverse of the momentum square that follows through this cut line, which is pk. Pk is equal to p1 plus p4. P1 is null, p4 is null, so here is your property. And I said pk meant capital K. Yeah, this little guy is onshore. But the vertices are the same. I'll write the same vertices here and here. The propagator is the same. So this is a trivial example of the factorization. And the one thing that I omitted to tell you is that, of course, when you write an endpoint function, you have to supply external line factors for every single line. In this case, you have to supply a line factor on this side of the cut and another one on that side of the cut. But on the two sides of the cut, this bloom has opposite helicities, and the product of the external line factors for the same value of the moment but opposite helicities is 1. So that includes the proof of the factorization. For the four-point function, now let's graduate to an example which is slightly more complicated, the five-point function. Again, I selected two gluons with opposite helicities, 1 and 5, to be referenced. And I'm going to take this diagram and to successively apply the recurrence relation. So what I'm going to do is to cut every single line on the unique path, which at the tree level connects the external gluons, 1 and 5. So in this case, for the first diagram, this one, I can cut the line denoted by K here, and I can cut the line denoted by L. And here the shifted momenta of the external gluons with the hat letters and double hat to denote that these are shifts that are distinguishable, meaning that this is a shift in the value of z such that I put this line on shell. Notice here I use a lowercase letter. Here I'm shifting with the z double hat such that I'm putting this line on shell. Again, notice the lowercase l, not a gluon which has been effectively put on shell. And multiply each of these two by the propagator of the line that has been cut. In this case, the propagator is associated with the line capital K. So I have a 1 over 2 and 2 squared. In the second case, the propagator for the line that's being cut is associated with this line capital N. Else I have a 1 over 4 P4 dot P5 squared. A 5-point function is not equal to just the single Feynman diagram, but I have to add all Feynman diagrams that are compatible with the cyclic ordering. For the particular choice of helicities and momenta. So there are two more Feynman diagrams that I have to account for. But in this case, 1 and 5, my reference gluons, are separated by only a single internal line. So I expect just this for the four-point function, the factorization is going to be trivial, in the sense that this is a true identity, trivial identity. So the only thing that I have to prove for you is that, remember, the vertices are the same here and here, so you can factor them out. So then the only thing that you have to do is, and in order to prove that factorization works, is this thing. And the essence of the proof is just an identity involving propagators, because here I have a propagator which is 1 over pk squared, a propagator which is 1 over l squared. Here, this propagator is affected by the shift of the external momentum. Again, here, this propagator is affected by the shift of this external momentum. So this is the identity for the propagator that we're supposed to prove. And just to remind you, you have two different shifts parameterized by z hat, z double hat, such that you place the internal lines capital K, capital L, respectively on shot. These are the complete expression for these z hat, z double hat variables. Again, this is the identity that we want to prove. And very little work is required to show that this propagator identity, which now we base our proof factorization on, translates into this trivial algebraic identity, which is nothing but just partial fractioning. So this completes the proof of the BCFW recurrence relation at the level of Feynman diagrams for the five-point function. So the same pattern is going to repeat if you go ahead and compute 6-point functions, 7-point functions. You're always going to stare at the same sort of algebraic identity for the shifts. So what is the deeper reason behind it? So we found an identity, everything is correct. But can we understand why we found that identity? And the reason why everything sort of holds together is nothing but the largest time equation. The property that we can assign an ordering among the sequence of points. And remember that I told you before that the appropriate ordering for these for the proof of the BCFW translation is not the usual one, which is timelike, but rather lifelike. So now I'm going to write this scalar propagator with the lifelike factor, eta, which I'm going to use to assign an order in among my sequence space time points. And this is what the largest time equation reads for the simplest Feynman diagram that you can think of, which has just two vertices and a propagator step between. So the propagator is equal to delta plus of x minus y, where delta plus is defined to be equal to the integral before t over 2 pi to the fourth times delta of p squared e to the I p times x minus y. Times a step function with argument x plus minus y plus. The step function is parameterized here by this integral dz over z minus I epsilon e to the I minus the eta x minus y. And of course, there's the second term corresponding to this. So notice that delta plus, because of this delta p squared factor, essentially amounts to have performing a cut, right? And notice our friend z eta shift, which is nothing but a parameterization of a step function. So this is what we exploited further, that the algebraic identity, which you saw earlier, involving those issues, we showed that it eventually emerges as a consequence of the largest time equation. And the largest time equation, if you never encountered this terminology, has been invented by Weldman more than 50 years ago in 63. And it's a generalization of the cut rules. And the cut rules, we all know, lie at the base of unitarity proofs and all that. So this is an even larger class of equations, which Weltman was able to write, according to the following set of rules. It's also called circling rules. If you're given a Feynman diagram with n vertices, then construct all copies, 2 to the n, including the original one, such that every single vertex can be circled or uncircled. For the circled vertices, you write down a factor of I. For the uncircled vertices, a factor of minus I. The circling operation has something to do with complex conjugation. A diagram which is identical with the one that you're studying, but with every single vertex circled, is nothing but the complex conjugate of the original diagram. The propagator, this is the interesting part, the propagator between uncircled vertices is usual propagator between circle vertices, as I said before, is just a complex conjugate of usual propagator. But the propagator between a circle and uncircled vertices is delta plus, or this is delta minus, sorry for this type. So suppose I have a diagram that looks like this. This is a propagator between an uncircled and a circle vertex. That's delta plus. What it means? It means that this line has been cut. It's been effectively differential. Here you have the delta star. And one formulation of the largest time equation states that the original Feynman diagram plus the diagram with every single vertex circle, that's the complex conjugate of the original one, plus the sum of 2 to the n minus 1 diagrams which have at least one vertex circle, or one vertex uncircled, is equal to 0.
So do you include the delta plus in the units of delta plus? Do you order x in one? Does it include the delta function?
No, you don't need any delta function. Delta plus of x minus y is equal to delta plus of y minus x. You don't need any ordering. This is just an integral with the delta p squared. But here is another formulation of the largest time equation, which does need an ordering. What you do here is to select two points, which you declare special, analogous to our two reference gluons that we had before, and we declare special because those were the ones that we decided we want to shift. And the whole factorization was written with reference to them. So now here we want to select two special points, space-time points, x, k, and x, l, And we want to assume an ordering among them. So if you have xk less than xl plus, then this is the content of the largest time equation, or this, if the opposite happens. And if you add those two equations, then you find a very interesting equation, which looks like this. Several letters are being written in boldface letters, and that has something to do with which vertices are circle, which not, that's less essential. But what you should keep in mind is that we have a formulation of the largest time equation, which needs two special points and an ordering between them. That's the ordering. And the shift of the two external momenta that we needed in the BCF W translation, this shift by z eta, is nothing but the result of the implementation of the step function that appear in the largest time equation. And if Freddy wants to raise an issue with the fact that eta has to be real, whereas in the BCFW reconciliation, eta is nothing but real, then I'm going to comment on that a little bit later. So here is how the story that I just described with for the five-point function, the factorization at the level of Feynman diagrams, unfolds in terms of the largest time equation. You can simply write the product of the two propagators associated with the two internal lines. So 1 and 5 are special. Two internal lines that had to be cut successively, K and L. These were the propagators. You can write them in a space-time formulation like this. Similarly, another space-time formulation for the shifted propagators. And remember, these guys were shifted by Zieta, and it's a fact that they have been shifted. It's a signal for such a step function to appear. And indeed, it does. And this is the way you'd write the largest time equation for this diagram. You have to write a couple more terms here involving the other two step functions, but I didn't bother to do so. I just wanted to isolate one single step function and write down for you the corresponding diagrams, because I can demonstrate quite clearly that only a single line is cut at a time. So for this diagram, which is multiplied by the step function x3 minus x1 plus, this is 3, this is 1, this is 2, this is 3. Now if you should interpret this in terms of some space-time diagram, now this line has a propagator between two uncircled vertices. That's an ordinary propagator. However, this propagator is being cut. So here we should be looking for the factorization that we noticed before. Again, here this is delta star, but this line is cut. It's a propagator between an uncircled and a circled vertex. And if you write down the largest time equation, which schematically I represented for you here. If you write all the terms that are needed, then you get something like this. On the other hand, the identity for the cut propagators that I have. Remember, one propagator was cut, the other was not. So we had so this identity in momentum space becomes this in position space. And already at this level, you can see that certain terms are immediately identical to each other. Well, that's the product of the two propagators in position space. Now this term here is equal to this one. This term is equal to this one. And the difference between the two terms that are left over when you map this identity in position space and the actual largest time equation, which is this thing, for that same Feynman diagram mapped in position space, the difference is written here. But you see what happens? You have two lines that are being cut and a single z shift because I have a single step function in order to ensure that those two lines are cut. I can't satisfy this condition. So I can't shift this momentum and this momentum with opposite amounts and simultaneously put on short both lines. It just can't be done. What that means, it means that the product of these distributions has zero support. Okay, so at the end of the day, we have shown that the algebraic identity, which was found by reassembling the Feynman diagrams into the BCFW recurrence relation, arises from the largest time equation. One more time. This was the algebraic identity.
So what you mean is that it has a volume, it has zero volume.
Yes.
Because if you try to use this in loop equations.
Oh, absolutely. At the loop level, it would be a completely different story. Absolutely.
Then those guys will
will contribute, certainly.
Something interesting.
Certain, yes. Yes, I know that. But for trees, then that's the end of the story. And this is the comment I was reserving for Freddy. In order to write the largest time equation, you need a null Lyapunov vector, so a real Lyapunov vector, so eta is real. However, for its Fourier transform version into momentum space, we chose to keep eta as a variable and then analytically complexify some eta real into this complex null vector, which is the space column gauge vector, plus minus. And by that same token, a general proof can be extended to massless or massive scalar particles coupled with the Anonymous gauge boson. And it leads to another trivial algebraic identity, which is nothing but partial fractioning. The factorization procedure that I just described for you for the at the level of the 4-point and 5-point function, generically, can be phrased like this. What you have to do is to begin by selecting two external norms as partial reference, and then splice the graph into a sum of products of two on-shelf graphs with shifting momenta. So in this case, there is at the tree level, there is a unique path connecting the external gluons, and one at a time, every single internal line belonging to that unique path connecting the external gluons has to be cut, and I'm supposed to add the products of these diagrams, which are now on-shell diagrams, multiplied by the propagator of the line that's being cut. So this is the factorization of three-level amplitudes. And this is the partial fractioning algebraic identity that I've been advertising. And the proof of this identity is very trivial. It's just straightforward application of Cauchy's theorem. Adding quarks can be done just as easily. So we saw before that it can incorporate massive scalars. Maybe I should stress again that the particles on the internal lines could have masses, but what's important is that the external lines that you selected, you put aside as special, and you chose to shift with respect to them and factorize with respect to them, these guys have to be null. But the propagators on the internal line can depend on masses, and they don't have to be equal. At the end of the day, you do get that. So just as easily, you can incorporate fermions. Here is the Lagrangian of minimally coupled massive fermions. And the recursion relations are formulated with respect to two reference bonds that are connected by a path which includes the fermionic line. This is the content of the of an onshore recurrence relation involving fermions. This is what you're supposed to show that it holds true. These factors here have something to do with insertion of external lines on the lines that have been cut for fermions. So that's why you have these slightly more complex terms. And the proof is, again, based on partial fractioning. This time, the contour that the contour is again at infinity, and the integrand is z to the m divided by z minus one, and so on, such that n is less than n minus two. And again, you end up with the sum of terms, which is just a direct application of Cauchy's theorem. So this is the story at the tree level. And I've been able, I hope, to convince you that you can have a Lagrangian-based field theoretical proof of the BCFW retranslations. Our secret weapon was the use of space cone gauge and the largest time equation to understand on a more deeper level, the trivial algebraic identity that we stumbled upon in proving the BCFW retranslations. We've been able to include massive scalars and fermions in the same framework. And what we're doing now is to see how to extend these methods at the loop level. You may be familiar with a set of works by Zwieber and collaborators on shell loop retranslations, but for the most part, they are based on inspired guesses or on beforehand knowledge of the end result and analytic properties of the amplitudes, you know, continuity on the complex plane. Then you try to use that same proof that Freddy and friends had for the three-level retranslations, but then you may or may not get the boundary term. Things are definitely more interesting at the loop level. And we'd like to have the same understanding on a fundamental level of what is happening. When you get boundary terms, what's their meaning, and so on. Along the way, we found an amusing fact that the dispersive integrals of Brandt-Hubbert, Spence, and Travaglini were looking at loop amplitudes involving MHV vertices. They phrased their end result in terms of a dispersive integral. Well, dispersive integrals are a hallmark of the largest time equation. So you can understand why Brandt-Hubbert, Spence, Travaglini stumbled upon a dispersive integral. And again, as one step along this program, extending our methods at the loop level, we have, of course, to compute loop amplitudes with the space cone gauge. And ask Warren Siegel if he ever thought about loop amplitudes in the space cone gauge. He didn't, so we're probably the first people to report how loop amplitudes can be computed in the space cone gauge. And since this is an axial, it's a non-covariant gauge choice, then subtleties are to be expected. However, we've discovered that space cone gauge is a little bit unlike light cone gauge, where you need special prescription for analytic continuation of the 1 over b plus dependence from the vertices. That goes by the name of Mandel van Liebrand in the light cone gauge. So you have 1 over b pluses which have to be analytically continued in a certain way. The naive prescription of principal value just gives the wrong result. However, for the space cone gauge loop amplitudes, nothing analogous to this Mandelstam-Liebrand prescription or subtlety seem to appear. And we've computed this one three-point function with same Halevsky gluons. Not surprisingly, it turns out to be rational. This is a result that has been known before, but we've been able to derive it through the use of space cone gauge. And well, we'll see what happens next. So thank you for your attention.